Hello and welcome to the Semantic Cybersecurity Brief, our fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Dick O'Brien and joining me today is Semantic Threat Researcher Bridget O'Gorman. In this week's podcast, we'll be talking an awful lot about ransomware because there's been quite a bit going on that front and a little bit about BEC scams.
Yeah, Dick, but I suppose first we should probably talk about Ukraine. I mean, I know it's a topic that we've discussed on several, I think, of the recent episodes, but we probably should talk about the situation in Ukraine again, because obviously, as we all know, this crisis is ongoing and there have been some developments recently as well, haven't there?
Yeah, I definitely think it's something worth checking in on, all right, because as I say, the situation is developing daily. For those who didn't catch our recent podcasts and may want to listen back, 4 weeks ago, we gave an update on recent cyber attacks against Ukraine, but also a good bit of background information on the what is quite extensive history of cyber operations directed against Ukraine, detailing various notable incidents and discussing the groups that have been mounting operations against that country. And then 2 weeks ago, we talked about our own research that was covering recent activity by the Shookworm group. Shookworm is also widely known as Gamereddon or Armageddon, and they are a Russian-sponsored espionage group that appear to be exclusively focused on attacking Ukraine. Now, obviously, since we last spoke, the crisis has by no means gone away, and indeed it's escalated further with news this week that Russia has recognized two breakaway regions of Ukraine and they've moved troops across the border into those territories. So serious escalation there. And it seems that the cyber aspect of this campaign is also continuing. So on February 14th, Ukraine's government announced that it was experiencing a wave of hybrid warfare, as it calls it, intended to undermine the stability of the country. And this came by way of a report from the Security Service of Ukraine, the SSU, as it's known. They said the country was facing attempts to systematically sow panic, spread fake information, and distort the real state of affairs. Some manifestations of this campaign were appearing on social media. And also, interestingly, they said in some mass media outlets. And it was in what they called the spread of narratives of the aggressor state by certain politicians. SSU said it wasn't just observing this campaign and noting it, but it was what it's called actively counteracting the campaign. So it seems like it was taking steps to stem the activity. It said, amongst other things, it had neutralized cyber attacks, it had dismantled bot farms, exposed agent networks of hostile intelligence services, and also prevented sabotage and terrorist attacks. So a couple of days later, after this report came out, things seemed to ramp up a little bit more because multiple organizations within Ukraine began reporting distributed denial of service attacks. Among the organizations that were being targeted was the country's Ministry of Defense and its armed forces, and also two state-owned banks, their Privat Bank and Ashad Bank. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. They'd also been hit. But alongside these DDoS attacks, bank customers began receiving text messages saying that all the bank's ATMs were down. And the Ukrainian police said that these messages were part of an information attack and, quote, they do not correspond to reality. The US government then got involved. They swiftly responded to this incident by saying that Russia was behind the DDoS attacks. They said it was Anne Neuberger, who is the Deputy National Security Advisor for Cyber and Emerging Technology, said Russia was behind it, said the US had technical information that links Russia's main intelligence directorate, the GRU, to these attacks. GRU is Russia's military intelligence agency, and it's kind of been heavily linked to groups, the group called APT-28. We call them Swallowtail. And indeed, the UK government also said that these attacks were linked to the GRU.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, really, how much is being, you know, revealed about these cyber attacks, how, you know, everything seems to get shared straight away. Like, that's not really the norm in these situations.
No. I mean, it's all been put out there in the open and in a very timely fashion. And I think it's kind of deliberate. There seems to be a definite intent to shine a spotlight on what's going on. And going by, I guess, media reports I've read, it seems that there is a kind of overarching strategy amongst multiple Western countries, particularly the US, to kind of share, be very open about sharing intelligence, because they believe that it's the best countermeasure to disinformation. And so probably being open and forthcoming about all the cyber attacks that are going on is probably a subset of that.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. I'd imagine we'll still be hearing a lot about this situation for a good while to come.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's only getting more serious as the days go on. And I wouldn't be too surprised if we're talking again about it in 2 weeks' time. Mm-hmm. But until then, let's turn to ransomware, because there's been quite a few ransomware stories in the news that you wanted to talk about this week, Bridget.
Yes, back to ransomware, our favourite topic, really. So IBM actually released its annual X-Force Threat Intelligence Index report this week, during the last week. And one of the interesting findings in it, among various other findings, was that ransomware gangs, according to IBM, have an average lifespan of about 17 months before they are forced to either rebrand or to disband. Although to me, that actually sounds like quite a long lifespan, really, for ransomware gangs. And, you know, certainly we've seen ransomware families, particularly in the last year, I would say, you know, come and go in a much shorter time frames than that. But interestingly as well, the report also found that the Rebel or Southern Ukibi ransomware gang was responsible for 37%, so more than a third of the ransomware attacks that were remediated by IBM last year, before that ransomware shut down due to a law enforcement takedown in October of last year. And that is obviously a large percentage of attacks, although I suppose maybe it's not too surprising, as we do know that Rebel was pretty prolific attack group before its takedown in October. And this report also did find, interestingly, that while ransomware does remain very much the main threat on the cybercrime landscape, the overall percentage of attacks that were ransomware attacks were declining, according to this research. And this is kind of interesting, and I suppose it may be linked to the large number of takedowns we saw, maybe in the kind of closing stages of 2021 particularly. And I suppose it'll be interesting to see, you know, if that decline is really start of a trend, or if we see a lot of these ransomware groups, you know, coming back potentially under, you know, different monikers, you know, pretty strongly, I suppose, once the kind of maybe the kind of heat from many of these recent takedowns goes down somewhat. So I think we'll all be watching that kind of landscape in general with interest. And another interesting finding I thought in the report was also the growth in cyber criminals exploiting vulnerabilities in unpatched public-facing systems, with this index finding attacks using public-facing vulnerabilities as an initial infection vector grew by 33% in 2021, with them used as the initial infection vector actually in 44% of ransomware attacks. And this does back up some research we did ourselves last year for our attack vectors white paper, where we did also underline the increasing use of these vulnerabilities in public-facing applications by cyber criminals. So that just seems to be reflected in this research from IBM as well.
And that wasn't the only ransomware report that was released in the last couple of weeks, was it?
No, Chainalysis, which is a blockchain analysis firm, which often comes out with quite interesting research, they released a report into some of the ransomware activity that they saw in 2021 as well in the last couple of weeks. And they revealed that over the course of 2021, more than $600 million was paid out to ransomware gangs in ransom payments. And while this is lower than the 2020 figure of $692 million, Chainalysis said that the ultimate figure for 2021 is likely to surpass 2020's payments, as often, you know, it does take months for kind of these ransomware payments to come to light. And the firm did also point out that while this may seem like a big number, you know, it's likely to be really not reflective of reality. It's likely to be the very kind of low end of the scale of what ransomware gangs are actually made in 2021 and actually are making in general, as you know, in most cases, we don't really see these ransom payments. They can't be traced. So the actual figure these cyber criminals are making is actually likely to be a lot higher than that. From Chainalysis' own research, though, they said that the gang that received the highest ransom payments, according to their analysis, was Conti, which made around $180 million in ransom payments in 2021. And this is followed by DarkSide, interestingly, because DarkSide was really only active for a couple of months. It kind of went quiet, obviously, after the Colonial Pipeline attack and the kind of controversy that followed that. But despite only being active for a reasonably short amount of time, it made around $85 million, or received around $85 million in ransom payments. And then these two were followed by the Phoenix ransomware and then Rebel as receiving the highest amount of ransom payments. And the researchers in this, they also highlighted an increase in the average size of ransomware payments. So the average payment was about $118,000 in 2021, which compares to $88,000 in 2020 and $25,000 in 2019. So that's a huge jump in, you know, 2 years. It's like gone up like by six times, which is massive. And there was also an increase as well in the number of ransomware families that were seen in 2021, with at least 140 ransomware families receiving payments from victims during that year, which compares to 119 in 2020 and 79 in 2019. And Chainalysis also kind of had a different conclusion to IBM when it came to the average lifespan of ransomware families, with its research estimating that the average strain was only active for about 2 months in 2021, which probably would seem to be more reflective, I would say, and is a huge decrease on, you know, previous years. And that decrease is probably driven by, you know, increased sanctions, increased pressure from law enforcement on ransomware gangs, you know, that's forcing them into more frequent rebrands. While takedowns are also, you know, appear to be having an impact on ransomware gangs at the moment as well.
And speaking of ransomware rebrands, one of the newer ransomware families, Noberis, it's a family that we've talked a lot about ourselves. They claimed responsibility for one ransomware attack this week, didn't they?
Yeah, so Noberis, which is also known as Black Cat or Elf, they claimed responsibility for a ransomware attack on the aviation services company Swissport International. As you said, Dick, we published about Noberis before Christmas when we said it was notable. It's the first professional ransomware strain coded in the Rust programming language. And since its initial discovery, it has been implicated in a good few ransomware attacks. And, you know, as we were talking about rebrands, you know, the people behind Noberis have acknowledged the link to the Black Matter or DarkSide ransomware gang as well. The actors behind it claimed in an interview a few weeks ago that they did with, I think, Recorded Feature, they claimed to be former affiliates of DarkSide or Black Matter. But some experts believe it's more likely that Noberis actually originates from the same developers and essentially is the latest rebrand for the DarkSide or Black Matter ransomware group. And this attack on Swissport at the start of February impacted the company's IT infrastructure, caused some flights to suffer delays, and the company didn't reveal what ransomware family was behind this attack. But on the 15th of February, Noberis itself published a sample set of files on its DataLeaks website that it said had stolen from Swissport, and the threat actor said it had over 1.5 terabits of data that it had stolen that it was willing to sell to interested parties. And this leaked data included things like images of passports, internal business memos, as well as what appeared to be details of job candidates, things like full names, passport numbers, nationality, religion, emails, phone numbers, job roles, and interview scores. So obviously a lot of information that could potentially be leveraged in, you know, fraud and those kinds of things. So I think staying on the subject of ransomware, there were a few things that you wanted to talk about as well, Dick. Including some news that it may be possible now to decrypt files that have been encrypted by the Hive ransomware without actually paying a ransom.
Yeah, this one is kind of interesting. It's not unprecedented that, you know, a weakness has been found in encryption ransomware, but it's still kind of rare, and it's still rare as well to see it happen in, I guess, a big name ransomware threat. So this is according to a paper that was compiled by some researchers at Kukmin University in the South Korean capital of Seoul. And what they found was weaknesses in Hive's encryption algorithm that made it possible to guess the decryption key. So they took a look at Hive and they found that it encrypts files by XORing the data with a random key stream that is different for each file. But what they found was that this random key stream was sufficiently guessable. I guess it wasn't random enough. Interestingly, they noted that the technique for guessing isn't 100% effective. And what they said was that the recovery, they usually allowed for the recovery of about 95% for the master key. Now, I'm not exactly sure how this works, but they maintain that even with this, the key can still be used to decrypt between 82 and 98% of encrypted data, which I guess for most organizations, that's quite a lot, you know, and could go a long way towards mitigating the impact of a Hive attack.
Yeah, that's definitely interesting. And as you say, quite unusual to find these kind of this kind of weakness in a very active ransomware, because Hive is really, it's probably one of the most active ransomware threats for the last few months, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it really is. I mean, you've probably seen this yourself. The ransomware landscape is constantly evolving and threats come and go. But over the past few months, Hive has certainly one of the most frequently seen families of ransomware being used in targeted attacks. The group who operate Hive, Symantec calls them Pinion. They operate as a ransomware as a service model, the usual thing where they recruit affiliates to carry out attacks using their ransomware in exchange for a cut of the profits. So, I mean, I guess in some of the recent Hive attacks, we've seen the first evidence of suspicious activity was remote execution of PowerShell using WSM PROV host exec. I think that's a remote tool for remote execution of PowerShell. It's actually the first time I've seen that mentioned in ransomware investigations. I'm not saying it's unprecedented, but it's one notable kind of TTP we've seen in these investigations. They generally followed this up with either Cobalt Strike or Meterpreter activity prior to ransomware execution. This is not unusual for targeted ransomware attacks, particularly with Cobalt Strike. And they also leveraged a number of operating system features such as Bitsadmin, NetExec, RegExec. Again, not too unusual. Interestingly, there was also some, I guess, inconclusive evidence that Citrix was also used for malicious purposes. So that's maybe something to watch out for. However, I mean, I should stress that since Hive is a ransomware as a service operation, it's likely that you'd see more than one set of TTPs being used to deliver the ransomware. So just to caution that not every Hive attack may unfold in this fashion.
Yeah, I mean, that's the nature of the ransomware as a service, really, isn't it?
Yeah, indeed.
And then finally on ransomware, there's also another new threat that the FBI have been warning about recently.
Yeah, it's about a ransomware called Blackbyte, which I think is kind of fairly new arrival on the block. I'm not too familiar with them myself. But anyway, it seems that they have compromised the networks of at least three critical infrastructure organizations in the US since the beginning of last year. So this is according to a joint advisory that the FBI and the US Secret Service released on February the 11th. They said Blackbyte had compromised multiple US and foreign businesses, including entities in at least three US critical infrastructure sectors. That's government facilities, financial and food and agriculture. And they were also named as the group behind the cyber attack on the San Francisco 49ers football team that occurred recently. So if you want to learn more about Blackbyte, that advisory is worth checking out because it includes plenty of IOCs and mitigation steps that organizations can use to try and guard against Blackbyte attacks. And actually, I think the next item we were going to discuss involves the FBI as well, because they also released an advisory about BEC scammers.
Yeah, so they also released a public service advisory on the 16th of February that warns about an uptick in the use of virtual meeting platforms by business email compromised BEC scammers. So the advisory warned recipients that between 2019 and 2021, The FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center had received an increased number of BEC complaints involving the use of virtual meeting platforms, which were then used to instruct victims to send unauthorized transfers of funds to fraudulent accounts. And unsurprisingly, the advisory linked this increase to the increased use of this kind of technology due to the growth of remote work during the pandemic. I mean, obviously, it's the exact technology we're using to record this podcast now. So while the advisory did not name any specific virtual meeting platforms that were used in these attacks or provide any statistics as such, the FBI did outline three scenarios where BEC scammers had leveraged these virtual meeting platforms as part of these attacks. And these included scammers compromising an employer, you know, like a senior employer, like or the financial director's emails, especially the CEO, the CFO, then requesting employees to participate in a virtual meeting, kind of all hands, something like that, where the criminal would insert a still picture of the CEO with no audio or some kind of faked audio, and then claim that the video or the audio wasn't working properly. And then they would proceed to instruct employees to initiate some sort of transfer of funds, either via the virtual meeting platform's chat function or else in a follow-up email after the meeting. And there was also incidents where they compromised employee emails in order to insert themselves into workplace meetings on these virtual meeting platforms to basically eavesdrop on these meetings to collect information on a business's day-to-day operations. And then obviously having this kind of information could then enable them to carry out BEC scams in the future. And finally, then they were seen in some instances as well where they would compromise another employer's email, like CEO, and then they would send spoofed emails to employees instructing them to initiate transfer of funds, which is obviously kind of the standard way we see BEC scams very often carried out. But they would say that the CEO couldn't do that at the time or couldn't speak at the time because they're occupied in the meeting, so couldn't initiate the transfer of funds themselves, things like that. So I suppose, you know, new tactics like this, they just show that, you know, these scammers, they continue to evolve their approaches, basically, in order to increase the chances of these scams, you know, succeeding for them. And really, organizations, you know, need to be aware that I think we're all very, you know, conscious of emails and being very careful with our emails. But, you know, it's not just emails that these scammers can kind of attempt to exploit. There's also, yeah, virtual meeting platforms, even just regular messaging platforms. And we see a lot on social media as well. People get a lot of kind of fake, you know, links and that via social media. So all these different platforms can be leveraged by attackers who are basically attempting to trick employees into most often making fraudulent money transfers.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many comms platforms that are being used nowadays, particularly with remote working. There's kind of a lot of avenues for attack. And it just goes to show how successful some scammers can be once they do a bit of research about an organization and learn who's in charge and what the structure is and all of that. And it seems to be very easy to make stuff convincing once they've done their homework.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, let's wrap it up there. But if you've been enjoying our podcast, don't forget to subscribe to avoid missing out on all of our future episodes. You can also follow us on Twitter at Threat Intel. If you'd like to read our latest research, you can check out our blog, which can be found at semantic-enterprise-blogs.security.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. We'll be back again in 2 weeks' time, but until then, thank you and goodbye.